work session so we could get through some of the agenda. We're not going to be able to get through the entire agenda today. There are a few bills in work session that I'd like to work before we adjourn to go down to the floor today. The rest we'll have back on the agenda. Mr. Dole, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Crime Victims United asks you to support Senate Bill 437. We feel that privileges should apply to past conduct and present perceptions and not to threats of future violent crimes. We certainly see and respect the value of privilege as an integral part of our criminal justice system. However, it is important for people to understand exactly what it is that is in fact privilege. In our system of justice, there is always going to be a weighing process between the rights of the defendant and the rights of society. Shielding threats of future violent crimes into a privilege serves no legitimate purpose. If someone tells their lawyer, doctor, or psychologist that he or she had planted a bomb on an airplane and it was going to explode the next day, society has little interest in protecting this kind of statement. If the privilege applies to threats made against other people, what about the situation where someone tells their therapist that he or she is going to kill their therapist and perhaps the therapist's spouse? Is such a statement shielded? It might be without Senate Bill 437, and that is absurd. The appellate courts in Washington and California have both addressed this issue and have plainly said that there is no privilege. In Washington, the Court of Appeals in State v. Hansen stated the reason for the rule, and I quote, "The necessity for unhindered communication is outweighed not so much by society's interest in having the truth disclosed as to crimes already completed, but rather by society's interest in protecting the present and future victims of the client." Likewise, the California Supreme Court in People v. Wharton held that a statement made by the defendant to his therapist 2 weeks before he killed the victim was in fact admissible. The California Court of Appeals similarly held that, quote, "the public policy favoring protection of the confidential character of patient psychotherapist communications must yield to the extent to which disclosure is essential to avert danger to others. The protective privilege ends where the public peril begins." We feel the law needs to be clarified. There is no reason to shield future threats of violent acts. Society has no interest in shielding such statements from being reported or used as evidence by the perpetrator. And Senate Bill 437 clearly sends this message. My one criticism of the bill is it is not broad enough. I wonder why there should not be an affirmative duty to report serious and real threats of violence towards innocent persons. However, the current amendments are a compromise, and I am not asking for such a requirement. In closing, I would say this, that we give a lot of lip service to crime prevention today, and some things work and some things don't, and I think you have an opportunity here to pass a bill that truly could prevent a murder, a brutal rape, or a brutal assault upon an innocent person. And I thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Dole. Representative Krieger.
Chair, can you make copies of your notes for us?
Any other questions? Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dole, were you involved in the work group that was put together around this bill to craft this compromise that you're talking about?
I was involved in a work group that was held last Friday that talked about the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I now ask John McCulley, Dr. Maggie Bennington, and Scott Gallant, if they would come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'm here primarily to introduce Dr. Bennington Davis, who will offer testimony on behalf of our organization. But I did want to acknowledge the work that has been done by Senator Minnis and the proponents of the legislation. We met with them following the approval by the Senate committee, met with Senator Minnis, expressed some concerns that we had to him, and he agreed to seek changes to the bill. After that, we met with the district attorney's office in Portland, talked about some possible amendments. And at one point, I have to tell you, I thought we might be able to reach an agreement on behalf of our organization. But the more that the members of our organization reviewed what was being asked for in Senate Bill 437, the more they became convinced that the best position for us to take was opposition to the bill. And that was a conclusion we reached after much debate and discussion on the measure. And just to let you know that the process that occurred led us to that conclusion. So I'll have Dr. Bennington Davis talk about the reasons that we reached that conclusion. She is the immediate past president of Oregon Psychiatric Association.
Yes, doctor, please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Maggie Bennington Davis. I'm here representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I am a psychiatrist, a physician. I'm also the medical director for Salem Hospital Psychiatry. I'm speaking on behalf, as I said, of the Oregon Psychiatric Association in strong opposition to Senate Bill 437. Oregon physicians, and especially psychiatrists, are opposed to this bill because its broad language cuts the heart out of a therapeutic relationship. Confidentiality is the core component that allows patients to talk trustingly to their doctors about all issues. With all due respect to Senator Minnis, physicians and psychiatrists in particular are not seeking allowance to reveal confidences. And the story that he told would not have a different ending if this bill existed in Oregon. The amendments that are proposed do not make this bill more palatable. The current standard of practice, as you have heard, in therapeutic relationships already includes warnings to potential victims of harm by patients who reveal threats. This bill is not a duty to warn. There is no privacy currently for information regarding violent crimes. Records regarding such events can and are currently successfully subpoenaed. Therapists in Oregon can and are called as witnesses. Legislating the standard of practice as it already occurs in Oregon is unnecessary. There is nothing wrong with the morals and ethics of physicians and psychiatrists in Oregon now, and doctors are not asking for avenues to report what they already feel free to report when it is in the best interest of society. Excuse me. Physicians, particularly psychiatrists, strongly oppose this bill's assault on the right of patients to speak confidentially to their physicians. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bennington Davis.
Mr. Gallant. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. I presented the committee with some written testimony, which I won't read through, but I would like to make a couple of observations and comments. Clearly, in the cases that have been presented to the committee, while it may be difficult for the district attorneys to obtain the information that they seek, it is obviously possible for it to occur through the courts, as has been presented to the committee. So merely because the current status quo is difficult doesn't necessarily justify the adoption of this bill. Secondarily, the very language of the bill requires, obviously, practitioners to make a determination of what clear intent actually is. In a 1985 decision by the Oregon Supreme Court, in some of its observations, it said the public interest to be served by notifying the police in most cases could be achieved by divulging only that information needed to show why a clear and immediate danger is to believe to exist. It would rarely justify the full disclosure of the patient's confidences to the police and never justify full disclosure in open court long after any possible danger passed. It would seem the other issue that I want to mention as well, this bill obviously affects any number of other privileges currently in statute, among 16 other particular statutes. And by the way, the bill treats some differently than others. There is in this legislation a proposed exemption for the clergy-patient privilege, which may be the correct policy decision to make. But on the basis of balancing the importance of individual confidentiality and that of society, I'm not quite sure what the policy difference is if the committee chooses to move forward with this. But other privilege statutes that are affected by this amendment include husband-wife privilege, public officer privileges, among others, which I don't think has really been elucidated by the proponents of this bill. The other observation that was made, I believe, by one of the committee members about being liable for failure to report, I would agree. I think this bill fails to provide a protection for a failure to report, but does, in fact, provide protection for reporting. And I can assure you, in the climate that we live in today, there will be litigation for failure to report by someone in the state if the committee chooses to move forward with this bill and does not include that as an amendment. Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my comments with that. Again, we don't believe the bill is necessary. We don't believe it clarifies the statute. In fact, it may, in fact, make it more muddled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gallant. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bennington Davis, I have a question for you. Dr. Colestro testified and gave us three reasons why this bill was a good idea, and I've heard just a little bit about why it's not from you folks, but the first reason he gave was that it codifies an existing duty to report. Can you respond to that?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, Mr. Colestro himself pointed out that already existing in at the beginning of a therapeutic relationship between a doctor and a patient, there's usually spelled out that there are certain conditions under which that treating physician may choose to breach confidentiality. Those conditions are usually driven by, as Mr. Gallant pointed out, something that is pressing and specific and imminently preventable.
So, Mr. Chair, in other words, you already know you have this duty to report. There's no need to codify it. It's already being done. And the other part that I kind of interesting was he said it would enhance the continuing education for all psychotherapists in risk assessment. Well, when Representative Barnhart testified, he said that there are 4 hours of continuing education credit and ethics already. Do you know if risk assessment is covered in your continuing education?
The Tarasoff ruling in California pervades all of psychotherapeutic relationship education. Tarasoff is very well known. It's the basis for much discussion in almost any continuing education forum for psychiatrists as well as other psychotherapists.
So this bill wouldn't change that?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Our last two witnesses that have signed up on this matter are Dr. Carol Carver and Bill Hauser from the OCDLA. If they would please come forward. We'll save you for cleanup if that's okay, Bill. And we'll ask Dr. Carver to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Carol Carver. I'm a psychologist licensed in Oregon, and I am president of the Oregon Psychological Association. I'm offering testimony on behalf of the association. I've passed out written testimony for you, but I'm not going to read that. A lot of the things that have already been said here, we certainly agree with. The association strongly opposes Senate Bill 437. We believe that trust, which is based in part on privacy and confidentiality, is the cornerstone of the foundation of effective psychotherapy, which is largely what our members do. And we do already break confidentiality in order to prevent harm from coming to others. And in the case of the child abuse reporting statute, we are required by law to report child abuse, even if it has already happened and we can't prevent it from happening. We do have that ethical responsibility to prevent harm where we can, and we take it very seriously. But Senate Bill 437 is sort of like trying to kill ants with a sledgehammer. You forfeit privacy for thoughts someone might have about committing a crime. You forfeit privacy because someone believes there might be something in the record that might not be privileged if Senate Bill 437 passes, and that would destroy effective psychotherapy. I have had an instance in my private practice in Corvallis where I fought a subpoena for the entire record of a client in a court case where the client was not a defendant in the crime that had been committed, and we went for months and months waiting for hearings, and you know, we had two of them, to quash the subpoena. And during that time, the client told me, after when we won and we didn't have to reveal the records, the client told me that during that entire time, psychotherapy was damaged because the client wasn't really sure what they could tell me and what the judge might read, even if the judge was the only person who might read the record. The client would have felt violated if the judge read the record just to see if there was something in the record that might not be privileged. If Senate Bill 437 passed, I can't imagine that I can do psychotherapy effectively under those kinds of conditions. Clients already know that if they're going to harm someone, I will report, and I tell them that up front. But clients say all kinds of things to me. You know, they get mad and they make all kinds of statements, but they're not likely to go out and act on those statements. And in fact, part of why they're telling me those things is so that we can figure out a way for them not to act on those statements. There are lots and lots of things that are in clients' private records that they don't want anyone to read. And Senate Bill 437 would allow at least one person, at least one judge, to read those things. Things like they had an illegitimate child that no one knew about. They had an affair. They called me up and they wanted to drive by their ex-spouse's house 10 times. Or they called me up and they told me they'd done it. And then they felt stupid and they didn't want to do it again. There are all kinds of things that people tell their psychotherapists that don't need to be unprivileged, if you will. And it's not just prosecuting attorneys who would see this. You know, when, with all due respect to Senator Minnis, he said he wants to allow us to provide information to prosecutors. But there are all kinds of other legal issues where subpoenas might be issued for clients' records that don't involve prosecutors. Clients get involved in contentious divorces, and they say outrageous things to one another. They make all kinds of threats. And then someone, namely a divorcing spouse's attorney, might issue a subpoena asking me to provide records so that they could look and see if there was also something in my record that they might have threatened or said that they wanted to wring someone's neck. I've had clients tell me that their spouse was abused by the spouse's father as a child, and that every time they saw their father-in-law, they wanted to wring his neck or punch him out. That's in the record. If they got into a contentious business dealing with the in-laws, and then the business went belly up, and the in-laws filed a civil suit and said, well, we think this son-in-law decided to destroy the business because he's mad at us because of what happened to his wife, then are they going to subpoena the records and look? Now, how far is this going to go, and what's going to happen to psychotherapy? It just seems to me like there's too much in the bill, and we already do what's really necessary. It's killing ants with a sledgehammer. We already break confidentiality, and that's not the same as eliminating all privilege for all kinds of things that people might say to open up their entire record for someone else to read
so that then they don't feel psychotherapy is private. They know it won't be. So we urge you, don't do this bill. It's a big mistake. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Mr. Hauser, by the way, I'll inform you that Coach Backman told me that my use of the phrase batting cleanup was inappropriate. That would be the fourth hitter as opposed to the last hitter. So I apologize for the inappropriate baseball metaphor. You were the on-deck batter.
Thank you, Chair Williams. And my name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Certainly, we can talk about all those issues of trust and violation of trust that have been talked about by other people, and I'm not going to get into that specifically because of time constraints. But I would like to concentrate a little bit of my discussion with you today on the first section, which is really the nuts and bolts of the lack of privilege for any communication, I suppose. In a situation where I might be representing someone who is charged with murder, the intentional killing of someone, and yet the issue that is going to be before the trier of fact is whether, in fact, it was an intentional act that caused the death of the victim or a reckless act that caused the death of a victim. And during the course of my representation of my client, I speak with him, and of course, during those times, I hope and I certainly instruct my clients that I want them to be very open and honest with me so I know exactly what's going on in their life and what they did and why they did it. And the person says to me, yes, in fact, I did intend to kill the victim. The question in my mind after reading the first or subsection one of this, when a communication that reveals a clear intent to commit a crime involving serious physical, et cetera, or death, whether that is just a future-looking or whether it also covers the intent to commit a past crime, because the language of this does not say that specifically.
No,
it is and a communication that is a clear intent to have committed that crime. And with the passage of this bill, would then I be a potential witness against my client because of the communication they gave to me concerning that past crime? Certainly this is not clear in my mind that I would be protected under that situation. A lot has been said during the course of the hearing that this is to help prevent crimes. And while I understand where people are coming from when they say that, if, for example, someone tells me that about a future, something they want to do in the future, and I feel compelled to disclose that, whether it be to the individual that is being threatened or to the police, the question that comes to my mind is what can the police, or the individual, of course, can sort of avoid the person who's making the threats, but what can the police do about it? There's not really a crime for future conduct. I suppose menacing is the only thing that came into my mind that comes close to some kind of future threat. But there's not really a crime for future threats. So what we're doing is we're saying be on the lookout, the police be on the lookout because this person's made a threat. But really the police can't do anything about it until actually some kind of crime has been committed. So when we take a look at this this amendment or the bill, well, it's nice to say it's to prevent future crimes. Really what it is a mechanism for prosecutors to obtain evidence to convict people who have committed crimes. It is to obtain evidence of intent or evidence of identification, because if a crime has been committed, for example, against a person, and it's unknown who did it, but there is this statement to one of the professionals that might have been represented by the people who are talking here at the table, saying that, he once said, this defendant once said that he was going to do something similar to this against this victim. Now we have some identification evidence of a crime that has been committed, and we don't like that. In fact, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is opposed to this bill. Other things that came to my mind, certainly police investigations, if there's no privilege, I suppose anybody can tell the police they don't want to talk to them, but would this cover police investigations that may be out there? And I was also going to raise the issue of deposition subpoenas. Depositions are there to investigate, to obtain relevant evidence. Would an attorney or other professional be required to submit to a deposition subpoena and answer questions concerning what could have been privileged or was privileged at one time but no longer is, and be forced to testify under those situations? Those are issues that I had to present to the committee, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Hauser, is there questions for either Dr. Carver or Mr. Hauser? Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you. I'm full of questions this morning. I don't know why. It's not an unusual occurrence, but this morning, this bill, it's a very small bill, But it sure is creating a lot of questions in my mind. Dr. Carver, I have one for you. We had some discussion about ethics training and stuff, and I wrote a note to myself, how do you know when you have a patient when it's a genuine threat as opposed to just something stupid they're saying? I mean, is that one of the things that you learn in your course of study or in your continuing education, how to differentiate between those two?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. It's one of the areas in which psychology and the other related mental health professions have a pretty poor track record. We tend to overpredict violence, unfortunately, because we are pretty bad at predicting it. So we tend to err on the side of caution. And so probably more often than not, we tend to believe that someone is going to harm themselves or harm others when, if we had done nothing, they probably would not have done so. So how we know, it's a very complicated bunch of factors that you weigh in each individual situation, and you try your best to predict how many factors that might contribute to someone actually doing that are present, and then you give it your best guess. But we're very bad at it. We do tend to overpredict.
Well,
we're bad at it in the area of being overcautious.
And that, Mr. Chair, that raises a second question for me then. If you're bad at it and you overpredict, it just seems to me that now if you're required to report every threat that comes up, and your testimony was very compelling in terms of talking about divorce. I'm a court reporter, and I've been in those depositions where spouses threaten each other across the table, and it's very uncomfortable. I can't imagine being a psychologist in that position, but I mean, it just seems to me that you'd start over-reporting and perhaps reporting something that may never come to anything, but it's a very fine line. I don't think I'd want to be in your position, but...
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Mr. Hauser, you raised a question that went back to one of my earlier questions, and that was how this privilege would fare under a subpoena, let's say, and how you raised it in the deposition context, and I guess it's... So, as you see this, let's say it's a deposition of a doctor, or in a case, a question is asked if the party to the case ever made a statement to such and such effect that would come under this exception. Is there anything at that point for the doctor to say, I'm sorry, I can't answer that? I mean, there's really nothing to go in front of the judge about, is there? You're asking about a particular statement that comes under a clear exception to the privilege. What is there to go ask a judge about at that point if the doctor says, I don't want to answer that?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, I don't think there is a reason to go before a judge. The law would be clear that there's no privilege, and so there's nothing to argue about.
Further questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you. Oh, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, just a quick one to Dr. Carver. Representative Barnhart mentioned that aside from the statutory privileges which we're dealing with today, there may be some ethical considerations with the psychologists that have a balancing test as to when disclosures would be made. If that's correct, could you give us some more information on that and perhaps give us an example of what would be reportable and what would not be? Ethically as opposed to evidentiary.
Yes, Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. Psychologists have an ethical responsibility to take action to prevent harm when we believe it's going to be done. Harm by one of our clients to another, or harm by one of our clients to themselves. An example. In my practice, I have had the experience of being unable to persuade an intoxicated client to get transportation to allow themselves to be transported to chemical dependency treatment. And the client left my office intoxicated to go to an automobile and drive. I went to the phone. picked up the phone, called 911, and talked to the police operator and reported the client as much as I knew about the client's name, the type of car I believed the client was driving in the direction in which I believed they were headed, and that that client was intoxicated and was a danger to the public. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much, both of you, for your testimony. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 437 at this time. Colleagues, in the interest of time, we're going to move relatively quickly through three more items, and for those of you who are waiting to talk about bills that we're not going to address today, I apologize. We'll put them back on the schedule probably for Thursday because we're still under 24-hour notice. It's the Chair's intention to deal with House Bill 2503 in work session, to take the testimony on Senate Bill 290 and to address Senate Bill 126 with the time we've got remaining. The remainder of the bills on the schedule, we are going to have to reschedule for another time because of our limitations and the length of the hearing on Senate Bill 437. Apologize for keeping you waiting. My hope was that we would have gotten further today than we did. With that, I will open a work session on House Bill 2503, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2503 comes to you from Representative Cruz. You have the dash three amendments in front of you, and they were adopted in subcommittee. At least I have them as being moved to full. Requires the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to impose a sex offender of the following conditions of supervision, and I've set forth what they are in the staff and summary, and that reflects the dash three amendments.
We had considerable testimony, colleagues, on this bill in front of the civil subcommittee. I think we had it on for a hearing and work session at least two or three times. I mean, in the criminal subcommittee, at least two or three times. The last issue, I think there were some potential concerns raised by Ms. Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project. She has sent me a note today indicating that she is satisfied with the dash three amendments, which I believe were adopted in the subcommittee. Am I right about that? I don't have an independent recollection,
yes,
of adoption.
My notes indicate, Mr. Chair, adopt the dash three now. Ask Kathy Osborne to talk to Diane Ray and Representative Cruz about her concern.
Right, and I think that's been done, and I think her concerns have been taken care of. So we have House Bill 2503 with dash three amendments in front of us. We have Ms. Ray here. If there are any questions of the full committee with respect to those amendments, seeing none, then the chair would move House Bill 2503 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on my motion? Hearing none, would you call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker.
Aye.
Representative Lisa Walker.
Aye.
Representative
Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Peter.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2503 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krieger, are you interested in carrying this bill? The right answer is yes.
Not enough.
Okay. We are now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 290. I'd ask Representative Ryan Deckert to come forward.
Senator Deckert. What did I say, Representative?
Yeah.
Old habits are hard to break. Senator Deckert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm going to disappoint you and be very, very brief.
Well, I promise that won't be a disappointment.
I'm here in support of the Dash 3 amendments. I have a constituent here with me who brought this concern to me, and thank you to Bill Taylor for help drafting this amendment. Mr. Mendenhall, who's seated to my left, brings a personal story to the table, and we have crafted an amendment, a very narrow amendment, to affect his personal situation. And maybe with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Mendenhall.
Mr. Mendenhall.
Chair, committee members, my name is Alan Mendenhall. I reside in Portland, Oregon. I want to say this is my first opportunity to speak in this kind of arena, so I thank you for this moment of stark terror. I specifically want to support the items on page 2 of this amendment, lines 12. It says, A, the person was a private security officer or was engaged in providing private security services prior to January 1 of 1995. And 14, the B, the conviction was entered at least 20 years prior to the date the person submits an application for certification. In order to do that, I'd like to tell a little bit about myself personally, because I think it's pertinent to my support of this bill. In 1976, I was convicted of second-degree assault, and I was placed on probation, and it was a barroom brawl, and part of that was I wasn't supposed to drink or be in bars or any of those kind of things, and I was supposed to pay restitution, and this was to go on for a period of 5 years. Quite frankly, I couldn't stay out of trouble because I couldn't quit drinking, and so I ended up back in court again, and I was sentenced to go to a treatment program. I told the judge I was sick and I needed some help, and that was true, even though I didn't personally believe it. And so I went through the Veterans Addicts Program in Vancouver, Washington. I spent a couple of months there and went through the program. I continued in outpatient treatment and went to AA meetings for a year as prescribed by the conditions of my probation. After that time, I quit going, quit participating in any of those events, and I did not stay out of trouble. Personally, in my personal life, I did not get in any more trouble, but in my personal life, I didn't get the clean part of clean and sober. Until 1984, my personal life was in shambles. I went back to talk to a counselor who I trusted from the VA program, and entered a 12-step program, and also contracted to do some group therapy and so on, and then my life began to change. And 3 years later, in 1987, April of 1987, I was hired by Reed College, who I'm currently employed with. I was given an opportunity because of someone knew what I was doing with my life now, or at that time, and it was decidedly different. So I continue to work at Reed College for over 14 years now. I've been promoted to supervisor. I've been acting director of the Community Safety, Public Safety Department at Reed College on two occasions. I think I've held a position of supervisor for the last 7 years. I want to continue working there. but I don't think my story is unique. I don't believe that a person can stay out of trouble for 10 years if they haven't changed. I don't believe they could stay out of trouble for 5 years if they haven't changed. And I certainly don't believe that they could stay out of trouble for 20 years if they haven't changed. You know, I don't believe that I'm unique. I believe there's lots of other people like me. I've heard there's about 7,000 people who have been put out of work because of this bill, or not this bill, but the Private Security Act. I believe it was good legislation in the beginning, and then it was amended, it was tightened up, and the exception that allowed me to continue working was removed, and it just doesn't seem fair. I'm a taxpayer and well-respected in my community. I'm a regular attender of church. I have the respect of my peers and the college. The president of the college has written some letters of support to the governor for me. I don't believe that this is a bad idea.
So, Mr. Chair, the only thing that I would add to this is that Mr. Mendenhall has been employed with Reed College in security as a security guard for 15 years. The college is very happy to have him, but was put at risk. His job is being put at risk unless we adopt this amendment. And I think his is a case of ones where we would want, hopefully, to craft an exception, a narrowly drafted exception, to allow where the college continues to want his services and he continues to do a good job for the college. and that's why I would ask the A3s to be adopted.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Mendenhall. Are there questions for either Senator Decker or Mr. Mendenhall? Representative Ackerman.
Just a procedural question. Do you know if, I suppose you're not eligible then to have this offense expunged from your record if it was a Class C felony, or it's not a Class C felony or less, or is that what I would understand?
No, no, sir, it's not. Okay. A Class B felony cannot be expunged.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Just a comment.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mendenhall, I just want to thank you for coming today. I know it's not easy putting your personal life in front of everybody, but I think you should be very proud of what you've done, and I appreciate Senator Decker bringing this bill over here.
Representative Walker, for your kind comment.
Thank you, Mr. Mendenhall. Senator Decker. Would now bring up Diane Middle and Brian DeLashman. Welcome.
Thank you.
We'll start with you, Diane.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Diane Middle, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Chair Williams and members of the committee, this bill obviously began on the Senate side, and what it was designed to do is basically each session we are required to come back as laws change, because the department, or actually the Board on Public Safety Standards and Trainings, sets conditions for employment and retention of employment and certification in the public safety field. One of the standards that the board sets for law enforcement officers, correction officers, and others is their criminal background or crimes that may be committed while they are certified in those particular positions. There are both mandatory ones that were under a statutory provision and discretionary, and the mandatory were the ones that we had to come back and fix every year. The Senate Judiciary Committee very appropriately recommended that since this the department is guided by a board of 23 members representing each of the constituents, and also because they receive input from advisory committees representing each of those constituents, that perhaps that responsibility ought to be given to the board with the department to enforce by the rule process, so that we did not have the repetition each session of coming back. That's what the engrossed version of the bill provides to you, is the Senate Judiciary's amendments to that, providing a much more streamlined process. And I would encourage you to pass that process. If I might, I would like to speak to the Dash 3 amendments while I'm here.
Please.
I was marginally aware, I wasn't aware of the Dash 3 amendments until this morning, but I believe it's the same situation presented itself in a bill at the beginning of the session, Senate Bill 662, which I don't believe ever received a hearing. At that point in time, I did request of our public, of our private security division, that they determine what the impact of that particular bill would be. And our records reflect that at least for those that we could document, there would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 28 other individuals that would then be allowed into the private security business. They had been employed working as private security officers back in 95. They did have crimes going back some 20 years, and those crimes included everything from criminally negligent homicide, assaults in all different degrees, robberies, a number of different degrees of robberies, manslaughter. One particular individual who had a murder without malice out of Texas has actually tried three different times under three varying names and Social Security numbers to get past. But he would actually be eligible then under this bill to be certified as private security. The amendment, from our perspective, goes too far. And interestingly enough, given the changes that the Senate Judiciary made and the original bill, giving the responsibility now to the board to set those mandatory and discretionary, that would also give the board by rule an ability to determine when and if exceptions or waivers should be made. From my perspective, a better process would be to allow the board to make independent decisions based after a full hearing on the facts, rather than drafting a law change that potentially encompasses more people than was intended. Thank you.
Diane, isn't it accurate, though, that the amendment basically just simply says that the conviction alone
shall not disqualify. It doesn't necessarily say that other instances, for example, an individual's untruthfulness in attempting three different names or three different social security numbers in and of itself would be a basis, it seems to me, to be disqualified. But this simply says that that a conviction 20 years where the person has not been convicted of a crime during the 20 years prior to the date that they submit the application simply means that that's not a absolute disqualifier. It still leaves to the discretion, it would seem to me, the ability to otherwise determine that the person was not qualified.
Chair Williams, the criminal disqualifier, I believe, is what the private security industry is after. Part of what they're trying to do is improve their image in that there were numbers of individuals in that particular industry which had criminal backgrounds. Ironically, there were at least 11 individuals other than Mr. Mendenhall that were actually truthful in their applications but had some of the crimes that I indicated in their history. So it still would appear that we would end up with more than just a single incident, and the conviction, I guess what I'm trying to say is it seems that the conviction is necessary if we're going to get to the standards that the private security interest was interested in having. Otherwise, they're left with a position where any of these individuals would be in any kind of a private security industry, potentially monitoring your home or the schools or any of those kind of things without any way to scrutinize, so long as they put it on their record, which I'm not sure that that's the kind of people we want doing private security in all the various situations that they do it. That, from my perspective, a better exception would be if there is a reason why that particular criminal history is not as severe as it appears on the record, then to allow the board, after a full hearing, to make the exception rather than to just assume it's not that bad as a matter of law. Because otherwise, I guess I have trouble with the straight face test in saying it's okay to have someone in a private security field where they often work alone, they have access to all kinds of things, and then to know that that person has either an assaultive background or a robbery background or something is the concern that I would express.
Further questions? Mr. DeLashman.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, I'm here today representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I marked my sign-in as neutral. Originally, Senate Bill 290 was an opposed number 2, which is a relatively high priority opposed for us. It was changed, as was mentioned, on the Senate side, so that it does allow the board the discretion to make a determination which convictions require denial or revocation. But I did want to bring up one particular point and just get it on the record, possibly establishing some direction for the DPSST. You've heard a little bit about mandatory versus discretionary crimes or determination that the DPSST would have in disqualifying or revocation. A concern that we have is the nexus between the crime and the operation or the job that they actually do. Some of the listed crimes between the discretionary and the mandatory that I've seen, including illegal hay hauling or hunting in a cemetery. Now, what does that have to do with the ability of a corrections officer or a police officer to do their function or their job? And those crimes could, in fact, lead to revocation or the inability to be certified in the first place. So we would like to put on the record that we would ask that the DPSSD, and obviously with the legislature watching this operation, that when they go through establishing those mandatory and discretionary, that they be very careful that they are establishing a nexus between the crime and the inability then for an officer to function in that job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeLashman. Are there questions? Okay.
Yes.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It would be, well, I mean.
Just one question. What's your position on the Dash 3s?
The Dash 3s are unrelated to anything that we deal with. I do not represent private security folks. I did, however, find the discussion and the concept of the Dash 3s going in one direction about allowing a person to function in a private security function at the same time it appears on when we're talking about actually certified people, we're kind of headed in a different direction with this bill. So they kind of pull in two different directions.
Okay.
Thank you. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 290. We're going to move to a work session on Senate Bill 126. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 126A comes to you from the Senate, the Joint and Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. And you have the -5 amendments which were adopted. The subcommittee authorizes the juvenile court to order a parent or legal guardian to pay the supervision fee for youth on probation. Allows the placement of a youth adjudicated delinquent prior to the age 12 in the Oregon Youth Authority once the youth reaches the age of 12. Clarifies that a juvenile department may enter into a diversion agreement if the youth is eligible for formal accountability agreement. Allows a youth court to operate if approved by the local county juvenile department. The carrier of the bill is Representative Ackerman.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I think that adequately describes it. I think on the supervision fee, I think it's on a needs basis, so it's not a mandatory requirement, but probably discretion of the court. I think the accountability agreement is a form of diversion, which is would be necessary or beneficial in specified cases, so I don't see any strong opposition to the objectives of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Mr. Dole has asked to be able to address the committee on this bill. If you'd like to come forward, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Steve Dole, President of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Our concern is around Section 5, and let me see if I can... I was just made aware of this today, so I haven't really had a chance to put together anything as far as testimony, but here's what we see going on in the juvenile system, and we see it time after time, and I almost refer to it as a dirty little secret within the juvenile system, and that's the fact that we see face sheets for kids, which are more commonly known as rap sheets for adults, where kids have crime after crime after crime, and I'm not talking about misdemeanor crimes now. I'm talking about felony crimes in which they have not been adjudicated. Now, we're not against diversion. That's not what I'm saying here. In fact, I mean, I really think it has its place. But sometimes in showing a layperson these face sheets, and I want to tell you, these are not 10 or 15 or 20 face sheets that I've seen. These are hundreds of face sheets that I've seen over the past few years. The layperson looks at this and they say to me, well, this looks like it's a program that encourages kids to get involved in crime. And I think at some point we have to draw some parameters around these diversion issues, which seems to have become an obsession with our juvenile crime system, and figure out how many bites we're going to give of the apple, if you will. And my concern here is not only that there's further victimization, but believe me, it's for these kids that get involved in crime, because the message we're sending to them is just continue on your way. And I think that at some point we need to get these kids in front of a judge, and we need to adjudicate them, and we need to remember that most of these crimes are in fact expungible. So once they are adjudicated, they've got 3 years to get their noses clean, and then they can get it expunged. But I think to continue diverting, in my opinion, is a real policy mistake, and as well as we're doing in driving down juvenile crime, I think we could do a lot better by being more cautious how we use diversion. And those are my comments.
Any questions for Mr. Dole on Senate Bill 126?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
The -5 amendments were adopted at subcommittee, so we have the bill as amended in front of us at this time. So the chair would move Senate Bill 126 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shadow.
The amendment being what?
The -5s were adopted at the subcommittee.
Oh, they were. Okay.
Yes. So this is to move the bill to the floor with a due pass. Okay, let's call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Aye. Dr. Dina Jane Butler?
Aye.
Representative Hurley?
Aye.
Representative Steve Alford?
Aye.
Oh, C and B, sounds the same.
Representative Walker?
Vicky Walker, please, aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Fisher?
Aye.
Representative Wood?
Aye.
Chairman Miller?
Aye. Senate Bill 126 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, Representative Ackerman to carry on the floor. Colleagues, that's where we're going to stop today. The rest of these bills will be held over. We will adjourn the committee. Thank you for your efforts.
We're on the moon.
Hi, Sue Hannah. Boy, I haven't seen you since we used to carpool together, huh?